Now here on Radio 4, it's time for the return of For One Night Only, the series that revisits the occasion on which a classic live album was recorded. In this special opening programme, Eric Clapton himself talks to Paul Gambaccini about the recording of his best-selling album ever, Eric Clapton, Unplugged.
I didn't really want it to be a record, to be honest. We had a bet on that. My manager, Roger, at the time, and I had a bet of $100 that it wouldn't sell, I mean, anything. And he won the bet, you know. And that, for a while, that $100 bill was sort of framed in one of the executive offices of Warner Brothers, you know. Hilarious.
The live recording that Eric Clapton didn't want released became the best-selling single live album of all time. Eric Clapton Unplugged started life as a television show. On the 16th of January, 1992, an audience of approximately 300 gathered at Bray Studios in Windsor to witness a recording for MTV.
The band ambled into the studio and took up their places on the stage. There was no fanfare.
It wasn't like, okay, we're getting ready for this big, huge, epic performance that's going to sell 26 million records or anything like that, but it was just trying something out, and then nobody could have imagined the impact that record would have.
The feeling in that studio at that time, with Eric playing and playing acoustic and playing songs he wanted to play, it's just beautiful.
Well, you ready?
Yeah.
Okay.
And is it your voice at the start when he says, are you ready?
Yeah.
That's your vocal.
That's my one vocal.
Guitarist Andy Fairweather Lowe. The show exemplified the therapeutic power of music. Eric's 4-year-old son Connor had died in an accident 10 months before. Several songs in the set reflected a father's coming to terms with the loss of a child. This was true even of the opening instrumental, Signy.
Signy was a boat. It was a gaff rig schooner that I chartered right after my son died. A lot of this was really linked to the passing of my son, the material, the emotion, and Sinew was the first chance I got in that long, dark period after the death of my son where I actually experienced an uplifted feeling, you know, about life. I just was on the open sea and I was writing. And that was just something that I played to kind of keep myself amused, and I thought it ought to be performed, really.
It was nice to have an instrumental. A lot of artists come on Unplugged and they don't ever think about that.
Alex Coletti was the producer of the still young MTV series Unplugged. The show presented major recording stars in small venues, performing acoustically without their normal amplification and production values. Several major artists had already appeared on the show, but only two records had emerged from Mariah Carey and Paul McCartney.
McCartney was limited edition, so we really didn't know what the selling power of the show was. It wasn't until Mariah put out I'll Be There and hit number one that we kind of saw what this could be, and Eric clearly surpassed all of that.
Who had approached Roger Forrester, the manager of Eric Clapton?
I would guess Rick Crim, our talent liaison at MTV at the time. I remember Rick received a fax, because let's not forget this was end of 91. He came into my office with it and said, I didn't even know the ask was out, quite honestly, because it was such a long shot that Eric had agreed to do it.
I never saw Paul, but the one that convinced me that it was a good thing to do and would work for me was the Hall & Oates one, where they did that John Lennon song, Don't Let Me Down. And I thought, that's incredible. This is not their repertoire, but what a great idea. This is a perfect opportunity to do any cover you want to do in a sort of intimate setting. And I thought, well, that's exactly what I like doing, really, because I came from pubs, you know, playing in the corner of a pub, old standards and blues. And so I thought, this might work. And then I started kind of woodshedding on it, really.
And you had some musicians in your active fold because you'd just done a tour in Japan.
Yes, and a fairly big band, too, and pretty well-versed. And we were working hard. So all that was necessary, really, was for me to come up with something to do that wasn't of the normal ilk, really.
I got the phone call from him, and he said, if you come up a week before and we'll go through the tunes at his house. I was staying in a hotel around the corner. This, for me, you know, I mean, it was unbelievable. And I wake up in the morning and go around to his house and say, "Morning, El." Can't imagine what that was like for someone like me. Because you never lose the way you feel about people when you're a kid. No matter how old you get, they still remain where they were when you were thinking, "God, look, I saw Cream at Windsor." So I'm going to go round there to his house for a week, have a cup of tea and play these songs. It's phenomenal.
Andy's a scholar, you know, of the first order, really. And to speed the process up, I worked out that the best way to getting to the quick of anything was to give Andy the task of breaking something down. And he would just spend 24 hours, 48 hours dissecting what it was we were going to do and coming back with a kind of layman's version of how it could be approached for a group, you know. So he would have everything worked out. And often, you know, he would work out what my part would be too. So he was really, you know, the groundbreaker on all of this stuff on Unplugged. And I don't know if did he take any credit when you spoke to him?
No, he didn't.
It's crazy, really, because he's such a humble man. But really, he was the backbone of this project. And I think it's actually time for everyone knew that.
He threw so many curveballs to me on that gig. He just showed me the song and I had to work it out.
Fairweather Low had a week rehearsing with Clapton in Chelsea, longer than the rest of the band, who had a couple of days to prepare as a unit. At least they were accustomed to Bray Studios in Windsor. Eric often rehearsed his shows on the big sound stage, but the band had never rehearsed acoustically. This twist raised particular problems for drummer Steve Ferroni.
Eric just pulled out a gut string guitar, a lot quieter even than your regular acoustic guitar. Even playing acrostic on the snare drum was overpowering for that. That was pretty evident at the first day of rehearsal that I had to rethink this thing. And I sent my roadie, I said, "Just go to the music store and just buy everything that you can find." He came back with triangles, shakers, brushes, and something that was relatively new at the time, what they call thunder rods now. They're just sort of little strips of wood, and it gives you the ability to actually play with, feeling good about playing without tippy-toeing around it, so you can still get the meat but without the volume.
Each musician had to adapt. Nathan East had to replace his electric bass with a brand new acoustic version. The first day at Bray, he couldn't work out why it sounded so strange.
It just sounded like a tub with strings on it, you know. We called it a litter box, and it was, you know, the little popcorn or whatever they put in there.
Once he'd emptied out those polystyrene packing peanuts, the bass sounded a lot better. While the band was getting ready, so was the audience. It was small and select and kept in the dark about the venue. There were about 100 invited guests and 200 winners of a Radio 1 competition. Pedro Baston was one of the listeners who knew the answer.
The question was, where did Eric Clapton live when he recorded I Shot the Sheriff? And I knew the answer was 461 Ocean Boulevard. It was before I had a computer or printer. So I thought the best thing to do was to send in, I think it was 200 postcards with the answer. And I won 2 tickets. But we had to meet outside here, Broadcasting House, and were picked up by a bus.
Nobody knew the venue. I've heard people that said, "Oh, you know, I tried to follow the coach and stuff."
Martin Adams got his ticket from a crew member. He still has it. It shows an early start, 6:15. Martin was first through the door and made straight for a seat in the third row.
The sound was, getting the PA was more important for me than visual. But I did feel a bit sorry for those guys that were told to sit at the side of the stage or behind the stage, you know.
My name is Barbara, and I was behind and to the right of the stage, but it was still an extremely good view, and I could see everything that was happening.
I remember down here behind me, there was a table with some people, and I was like having like running conversations with them, and they'd say something like, "How are we doing?" You know, and they'd say, "Oh, it's great, it's great." Like, "Let me know if I'm screwing up." You know?
Well, that is an intimate gig.
Yeah.
The set designer had attempted to evoke a sense of intimacy by using drapes to create the effect of a nightclub.
It was very dark, with the stage all lit up, and I deliberately asked everybody, all the audience, to come in dark clothes, I suppose, so that they wouldn't show up too much.
Eric
put a lot of thought into how he structured this set list. Some of these songs were new to me because it wasn't the traditional, I'm going to do my hits, just acoustic kind of approach to Unplugged. So there was a bit of an education for all of us, I think, in this show.
The set list reflected Clapton's deep knowledge of the blues, which had sustained him since his youth.
I actually saw the first example of blues music on TV. It was The Tonight Show with Cliff Mitchellmore, and he had a bit of footage of Big Bill Brunsey playing in a French nightclub, and it was so exotic. It was the hardest called thing I'd ever seen in my life, and it was like someone turned something on in me. And so, you know, I just went looking for it.
And you've got Bill Brunsey on the record, actually, with Hey Hey.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing he played on that TV show. It's just breathtaking, the power he had in his hands. He's a great singer, a great ambassador of the blues, really, because he was traveling. I mean, he was one of the first guys, I think, that sort of took it on the road internationally.
Hey, 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 baby, hey.
Did you have any doubt that the intimacy of a 300-seater might be a bit difficult?
Oh, yeah. I was really unsure how it would sound. If you've got the monitors working right, you can be under the impression that everything is balanced. But if you put a bunch of people in there, it would affect the dynamic, the tonal dynamic, quite a lot. So I wasn't sure until we actually started playing, and then I thought, oh, well, like, everything sounds like it's in the right place. But I was nervous.
I thought Eric was really nervous. I guess he was used to playing in the big settings and the big arenas, and, you know, there's something to be said for getting lost in a crowd.
Keyboard player Chuck Lavelle had reason to be nervous himself that night. He had previously supported Greg Fillinganes in Clapton's band. This was his first appearance with Eric as the only man on his instrument.
When you get into that really intimate setting, and very different from the big tours, I think there was some concern, are we going to be able to pull this off, you know?
You can't hide behind an amplified sound or a fuzz tone. You're not relying on production. This is just everybody's fingers connected to their instrument, pure heart.
It wasn't just players like Nathan East who were feeling the heat. The backing vocalists were too, according to Steve Ferroni.
Tessa Niles, who never smoked cigarettes, had never seen her with a cigarette before, I lit up a cigarette, and she took the cigarette out of my hand, and she took a big draw, and I lit it. I said, what are you doing? She said, I feel so exposed out there. I've never felt so exposed like this.
Tears in Heaven directly addressed the loss of four-year-old Connor. The song first appeared in the 1991 film Rush. Director Lily Zenick had persuaded Eric he was the only person who could compose the soundtrack. Tears in Heaven had become a number two hit single in America, but Unplugged was the first time it was performed live.
I must be strong.
I've read a quote from you which said that to you this demonstrated the cathartic effect of music.
Mm. I had spent a lot of time in Antigua. I'd gone to Antigua to hole up on my own, really, and just reflect and get away from everything. I didn't know how to deal with reality, really, for a little while. And all I had was the guitar, and I was playing. I was trying to compose My Father's Eyes. I had written Tears in Heaven quite quickly, you know, it had just been the first song that came out, along with The Circus Left Town. Lily Zanuck taught me into putting it into the film, and I wasn't sure. I'm now sure I think it was a great thing to do, because it kind of undercut the drama of it a little bit to where it was just a song, you know, it wasn't such a big deal once it was in the film. And I felt it was the right thing to do in terms of sharing my experience, my grief, the pain, that it was a good way of channeling that into music. But also, I thought, you know, this has happened to thousands of people before, and this is a question, the nature of which a lot of people have experienced and not been able to verbalize, you know, what happens now? Where will this go? And that was a kind of fundamental question that I had to ask. And I thought, well, it may be useful to some people, too, who don't know quite. I mean, I have to say at this point that I've always had a fairly strong faith about something or other, but it's very indefinite. And I wanted to actually pass that on by saying that you could ask that question. It was okay to ask that question rather than just be angry and bitter and sad.
It almost felt like we were intruding on his personal grief, but he was sharing it with us, and I think we were privileged for him to do that.
I never understood where you get that kind of strength. I think the whole band felt that way, and there was nothing bigger than that particular song.
He always held it together, and I'm sure it was in honor of Connor.
A girl walked up to the stage and put a bunch of flowers on the stage.
For me, that song was just like it came from heaven, you know, because it was written 1,000 years ago, you know.
The material performed that night in Bray ranged from the poignant new material to blues songs Clapton had loved all his life. Once I lived the life of a millionaire. Eric had first recorded Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out with Derek and the Dominoes.
That was the first song I learned to play that actually had more than three chords in it. I heard it in folk clubs, when I was sort of bumming around on the streets of London, when I was about 15, 16, everyone was playing that song. It was a standard in the folk clubs, you know. But that's been kind of the core of my repertoire ever since, and I still do it.
Does he sing that, or does he sing that? I would even say, can we do it again? Huh? Now, can we just do it again?
For my money, the revelation was his voice. Never heard his voice so clearly and so emotional, because it's always been overly amplified in concert. This was not, for me, about Eric Clapton, guitar player. This was about Eric Clapton, the singer.
Eric has such good mic technique to begin with. When you get
back on your... Buford Jones was at the sound mixing desk in the studio at Bray. It wasn't just the vocals that concerned Buford. The integrity of the show required that the instruments remain truly unplugged.
We did not want to put any sort of pickup device on the guitars. And I, over the years, had tried many different mic techniques. And the one that I'd suggested there with Eric, the microphone is placed a little closer to his ear, the way he hears the guitar.
Smack dab in the middle of the set came the biggest surprise of the night. Layla was one of the best-known songs of Eric Clapton's career, but it had never been heard like this.
On one of the mornings that I went to the house, go in the kitchen, cup of tea, he's sitting in his chair with his guitar, and he says, I'm thinking of doing another version of Layla.
I just thought we should try this as a shuffle, because I love that thing of changing tempos. It's a good way of just looking at something from a different angle. And because of the key, it's very high to sing if you do it in the rock version. It's at the top of my range. And I thought, well, you can't play it like that. And then so you have to sing an octave down. I kind of thought, well, actually, it sounds quite nice. It's sort of jazzy, you know.
Oh, man, it felt natural to me. In the original recording, the piano really, it doesn't have much of a feature until the end where you have that reprise. But this version of Layla gave me some space to play during the body of the song, which worked out well for me. It gave us a chance to interpret it in our own way, and it did work out well, and it gave it a rebirth, I think.
My first impression, to be quite honest, that I don't really like this that much. And then each and every time that it played through, it just grew on me, and I thought, wow, how unique.
I think it takes a brave man to kind of tinker with that one. When I first heard it, I just thought, it's just a novelty, you know. I never assumed that it was going to be a worldwide hit again. I'm sure Eric didn't.
It's a great relief for me, because we were always chasing Derek and the Dominoes, and believe me, there were one band that got there. To be able to release yourself into this acoustic version of it and go, oh, no, it's a lovely song.
When we cracked that, I thought, we've got a good show here. We can do alternative versions of anything, really, in this framework.
So that, I would imagine, has given you a sense of liberation.
That confirmed for me I could have some faith in my ability to interpret things, which is what I love to do, actually, has become my favourite occupation. There are so many songs in the history of music that I love, that touch me deeply, that are by artists, where people say, oh, you can't do that. It's untouchable. That's probably true, but maybe I can do it in a different way, you know.
Possibly the most different way anything was done that night at Bray was San Francisco Bay Blues. After all, it was the creation of a one-man band, Jesse Fuller. The song was another Eric first heard in his teens.
There was a sort of floating repertoire with all the old guys that were playing in the folk clubs in London. San Francisco Bay Blues was a popular song. And then I found out about Jesse Fuller and all of this elaborate stuff he had, you know, the foot pedal bass and all of this. Great sound.
To get a great sound at Bray, Andy Fairweather Lowe found himself playing harmonica, despite his misgivings.
The only day I had to practice the harmonica was the day before. So I put the harness on, and I go like that, and the thing falls out. That's my only chance before the gig. The next time I'm going to play this thing is live, and I'm not an harmonica player.
Andy was not the only member of the band playing an unaccustomed instrument.
I kind of had a tough time trying to make a noise with the thing, so my kazoo part is very light on there, I can assure you.
I don't think we did any particular miking on that. I think they just kind of handled that naturally. That's a first, and actually I think the last.
Many of Eric Clapton's favorite blues artists are represented on Unplugged. Bo Diddley is there, and Muddy Waters, and with two songs, Robert Johnson, who died at the age of 27 in 1938, but inspired many artists in the 60s.
I keep drinking malted milk, trying to drive my blues.
He's been there in the background of my thinking and listening all my life, and it's the sharpest edge I can think of in the blues catalogue, really. That, I mean, Muddy Waters and him, I think, took it to a place where it was so fine and so sophisticated that it became impossible. I mean, there is no way to ever try to imitate those guys. The touch was extraordinary, and their ability was phenomenal.
Malted milk, malted milk.
I get a phone call, I'm at home, and you check out Malted Milk. So I put it on, and then I phoned it back and I said, you sure? Want to do this, because this is the most untypical Robert Johnson song. It's got diminished chords in it. In fact, that guitar style is Lonnie Johnson to a T, and it was a tricky piece of work. No DVDs, no books. You can get them now. I wish I had one then. And I just spent, you know, forever working out the chords and the sequence. I remember the first time we did it, there's a little lick at the end, you know. He went to play it, and because he hadn't really, you know, listened to it that deeply, and I knew the end of it, he said, oh, well, you do it. I said, don't come to see me do the end of the song. We'll wait until it sinks in, you know, and that's exactly what happened.
Thank you.
By this point on the album, it's obvious that you have succeeded in slipping a blues album past the general public. And it's now in 23 million homes or
it's
whatever.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the final song, which is on the record, is one that wasn't planned on being on the record, Rolling and Tumbling.
I think there was a technical problem. So I just thought, well, I can't just sit here. I just started to play that. And we were off and running again, in the wrong key, I think, too.
Well, I woke up this morning, my biscuit roll.
Just started breaking into it. I kind of joined in and thought, what key's in it? I think I got there in the end.
Come in, baby. Sit down, baby.
That was really my chance to really sort of get stuck into the drums on a more normal level, so I could actually play with the split sticks, feeling like I was hitting the drums, but actually not drowning everybody out.
We were changing tape, and next thing you know, quick change tape, let's catch it. And Eric was just beaming, and as soon as it was over, he looked at me and said, did we get it? And I said yes. I wasn't really confident we had it in the can, but I didn't want to say no at the time. And luckily we did get a record of it and were able to use it in the show.
After several screenings on MTV, there were requests for a soundtrack album. There was something about this unique project that cried out for release and kept crying out all through its 2.5 years in the charts and 6 Grammy Awards.
For me, it was a TV thing. And even as I was performing, I thought, this is pretty ropey, you know. I don't know if the tuning was right, pitching was dodgy, and some of the stuff just didn't feel like we got it far enough into rehearsal, you know. But there was so much encouraging feedback from everybody on the floor and that was involved in the making. I thought, well, I'm often wrong about this kind of thing, and I could be. So let it be.
And then, of course, it starts to sell. And I know you're not a chart watcher, but nonetheless, at some point, somebody must have said, you know, this is doing well.
Yeah.
Could you remember that when that happened?
Yeah. I was shocked, really. I was very pleased. I mean, it was encouraging to me to know that my abilities in their most basic form had some kind of appeal. It meant something to people to hear that style of music. It just validated my taste in what I was listening to and the history of music, because that's all I see myself as, is a messenger.
And that is, I suppose, the legacy of the record, because without this album in people's collections, they wouldn't have those songs.
Yeah.
So, mission accomplished.
Yes.
3.5 hours of your life playing your heart out, and for that to have so much impact when we spend so much time arranging and producing and making these things that everybody's trying to sell records, and this was the other way around.
I just thought it was great. I've had a marvelous career working with a lot of different artists in my day, everybody from the Stones and Allman Brothers Band, and I have so many great memories, but I have to tell you that Unplugged was, that stands out as one of the very, very best.
You know, I go into a lot of people's houses and I like to look and see how many records that are played on in people's houses. I guess one of the ones that I find most often is Unplugged. I think I did a damn good job on that record, as did all the musicians on there, and I'm really grateful that all these years later, you've actually come around and decided to talk to us about it, you know?
So in terms of your career, it's one of the nicer days spent.
Yeah, it was a great day.
Eric, amongst your many recordings, where does this sit?
I'm very proud of most of my work, but this one is the odd one out because it's the one I didn't mean to make. It got out against all of my manipulation and maneuvering. It sold despite itself. So I suppose it's kind of got a unique position amongst all of it, really.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
Did you get that?
And you can get more on the Radio 4 website, where you'll find an extended interview with Eric Clapton. For One Night Only is presented by Paul Gambaccini, and the producer was Maria Burgess.
The reasons I wanted to do this program were threefold, mainly in terms of themes. One is, of course, the marvelously hilarious story that an album not made to be a record turns out to be the best-selling single live album of all time. The second being that outside of a couple of headline compositions by yourself, you managed to sneak a blues album into about 23 million homes. And the third is the cathartic power of music.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, were you aware of the Unplugged series before you did it? Did the initiative come from them or from Roger Forrester?
A bit of everything. Roger, I think, was very keen on the idea. I wasn't sure until I saw Elton's and I saw how that gave him a different angle on performing. It just seemed to be a very natural environment. I never saw Paul's, but the one that convinced me that it was a good thing to do and would work for me was the Hall & Oates one.
Now, you had been in Bray before as a rehearsal space, hadn't you?
Yeah, we always used Bray because it was a place where you could set up your entire rig. You know, you could put up the lights and the full-size sound equipment too, so it was a proper film sound stage and it sounded really good.
You said you didn't have much rehearsal, and I know with the whole band you only had 2 days, so that must have been pretty intense.
Yeah, what happened was that I came here into this house in Chelsea, and I started woodshedding on my own for a little while. Then I called Andy, and he came in, and the two of us would play acoustic guitars and work out the different arrangement on Layla, for instance, and some of the things that I thought would be interesting to do that we'd never done before, like more, the Robert Johnson song. I wanted to do Malted Milk, and I wanted to do the songs that I'd written, but I had no idea at that point how to convey that or transmit it to the band, and so it was Andy's job to kind of oversee that. And then we went into rehearsals with the guys, and I only had a couple of things in my head that I thought were important, your bass drum patterns on some things, and really it was Andy was the MD, you know.
Andy, yeah. Being Welsh, it's always intrigued me that the musicians who so loved the blues in the 60s did so in different parts of the country,
yeah,
without any social network, at least that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
How did the music get through to you guys?
Being in the Merchant Navy was a big deal, it seemed to me, in the 50s and 60s here. A lot of people, Tommy Steele was in the Merchant Navy, you know, and he came back. They all came back from New York, these guys, and I think the people up in, you know, on Merseyside were hearing stuff because of the Merchant Navy coming people, and it was something that I was right on the back end of, you know, when I was got chucked out of art school, it kind of lurked in my head as a possibility of something to do. A lot of kids did it. It's a bit like doing the stuff that they do now where they go off for a gap, but a lot of people joined the Merchant Navy. It was very, very good money, and you went to the fantastic. So people came back from America with 78s and 45s of, you know, all of these amazing people. So it filtered through, and all over England, people were doing it in, like you say, little hamlets and different cities. And
you chose to play a Martin acoustic?
Yeah. I think I bought it in Nashville a long, long time ago. It's an OM, it's an orchestra, and I think it's gone now. I think it was part of one of the Crossroads auctions where I donated it, and up until the point where I parted with it, I'd never come across a guitar that had such an easy playing feel, because I'm quite lazy and I'm, you know, not particularly aggressive in my... So I need the guitar to be fairly friendly. About then or thereafter, I got wind of the fact that they would make guitars to my spec, Martin, and we did the deal where they would make a signature model for me, which was exactly this, based on that guitar. I would never have let that guitar go because it was a one-off. But in fact, the guitars they've been making since then have been identical, really.
And you're quite right. You did let it go for a Crossroads auction, and it went for £434,000.
It was fantastic, isn't it?
Yes.
Worth every penny, too. If I say so. I don't know if I would have paid that much for it, but I probably paid about $1,000 for it, you know, second-hand shop. But that was my thing, you know, Paul. I loved the road. In the old days, it was a different story because stuff like this had no value. You could pick up a Stratocaster for $100. I'm not kidding. A 50s blonde neck Stratocaster. All Martins like that. All Gibson F-hole archtop guitars. None of them had any value because Rickenbacker were, you know, top of the charts or whatever. I loved to go on the road to go around the pawn shops, secondhand shops, and pick up beautiful things, which to me had history, you know, but they were worthless to everybody else.
We get to Tears in Heaven, and of course, this is the first time you'd performed this live.
Yeah.
And it had been in the Rush soundtrack.
Yeah. I was asked to do that movie score, I mean, at some point during that 12-month period after my son died, and I had written. I had spent a lot of time in Antigua. I'd gone to Antigua. And then I got word that this lady, Lily Zanuck, wanted to talk to me about working on a film. And I thought, no. There's the last thing I want to do. And I met with her, and I kind of took... I liked her a lot, actually. I do like her a lot. We're old friends now. And she just managed to convince me that I was the only person she would... I mean, that was the way she put it. I don't want anyone else to do this. And you will understand why. And, of course, the film was about addiction and undercover police work and all that, and it was quite a tragic story, but based on true events. So I was kind of hooked a little bit, and I thought, well, you know, that if she can make it easy enough for me to do this, I will have a go. And we got on with it, and at some point I think I may have revealed to her that I had this song, She taught me into putting it into the film, and I really thought, I wasn't sure. I'm now sure. I think it was a great thing to do.
Tears in Heaven is followed on this album by Lonely Stranger, one of your songs, which isn't on one of your other albums.
Yes. When Lily asked me to go to Hollywood and do this movie, I was still in a state of shock, really, and I got into my hotel in LA and I felt incredibly lonely, and I started to write this song about being in a place like Hollywood or Los Angeles, and well, I should know lots of people here, but I might as well be invisible, you know, for all that's going on. And so it was born out of that, really. And I like the song, but I've never really tried to do it outside of that framework. I mean, it's an unplugged song.
We come to Running on Faith and Jerry Lee Williams, who's a writer who did not enjoy a long life, unfortunately.
No, I wish he was still around. He came over and stayed with me for a little while. After I did Forever Man, we became real good friends. And I had stopped drinking, and he was not near stopping drinking at that point. And it was quite, you know, I've never really known how much of it is my business to try and point that kind of stuff out. I found it difficult, though, and at some point from time to time I had to withdraw, you know, because it was pretty hardcore. But he was incredibly gifted, and I can't tell you how much I would have liked to him to have been well known. But he had this gene who was just so self-destructive that he wanted that, but he didn't want it. He would sabotage every effort that was made by other people to put him into the spotlight, you know, when the record companies, and they'd give him money to go in the studio, and he'd go in and he'd blow all the money on something else. And he'd write songs. He was very clever too. Another self-destructive, he'd write two songs, a guitar solo, and then finish. So, and he'd give you some, well, it's not, well, that's it. You either want it or you don't. And you think, well, it's kind of almost impossible to perform because you need bridge, or you need a bit more substance. And so he was a very complicated man, but he was the most gifted singer and musician and writer I'd ever met in the flesh, really.
And he did have a couple of spasms of success. Delbert McClinton,
yes.
Giving It Up For You, Love. Bonnie Raitt,
yes.
Nick of Time album.
Yes.
So he deserved more.
Yeah.
We then come to Walkin' Blues.
Yeah.
And your great hero, Robert Johnson.
What I got from listening to him was the strength in isolation. He was a complicated character, apparently, traveling around on his own. And he had honed his craft to his own satisfaction to the point where it was impossible to get it any better, you know. And there are a lot of other people around at that time who got close to that. Leroy Carr, I believe, was another one who played the piano in the same way. But he took it the furthest, as far as I could see.
Like Buddy Holly in the pop field, his death was so early.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder what he might have accomplished.
Yeah. There's enough material for two albums, that's all. I don't know, though. You know, that's the way it was probably meant to be, for some reason, that maybe he would have carried on just doing those songs. Who knows? It would have been, you know, an unplugged version or an electric. You know what I mean? That he may not have written anymore. He may have just stayed with what he'd... Because it is a life's work, in essence. What he put into the building of each song was a masterpiece in itself. So it's beyond what a lot of people have achieved in an entire lifetime.
And Malted Milk, which is a great title because, of course, the song is not about malted milk.
I don't know what it's about. What I liked about Robert Johnson was that I would find out where he got certain things from. He did get a lot from Leroy Carr, and this came from someone else, Lonnie Johnson. He was an exponent of that sort of sweet B.B. King style of playing, and Robert obviously got that from him. That really interested me, that he was quite openly either paying homage to or stealing from, you know.
And here we get into Lead Belly. With Alberta.
Yeah. No. That was Snooks Eaglin.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Oh,
sorry,
yes,
for correcting.
Sorry. Oh, yes. Arranged by Lead Belly.
Oh, well, I didn't even know that he'd arranged it. As I was discovering, a lot of the black artists from America in the 60s, early 60s, one album I came across was Snooks Eaglin, Street Singer. And he was one of these guys that would interpret, like, he did a version of Malaganya, you know. Because he was a street artist, he had to have a fairly flexible repertoire. He did the original version that I heard of Alberta on 12 string. And he is still one of my favorite musicians too, Snooks Eaglin, because he's an incredible guitar player, great singer, and eventually became quite well known and could afford to live off the street. But he always sounded like he was on the street to me. So.
We come to one of your old pals, Robert Cray, and Old Love, which you go on for about 7.5 minutes. So you got to love it, right?
I like that version, actually. It's the best version, I think. And because when we recorded it first, it was on Journeyman, I think. And, you know, I hadn't known Robert that long. I knew him as a great writer. And I wanted to see if we could write something together. Because how many writers had I met in my life that were blues writers? There's not... I mean, Robert is probably one of the few blues writers in the world. He can write an album of new blues like that, you know. And I wanted to see where it would go. And I think as we were recording it, we were writing it. So it was one of those things that I don't think it saw its full growth when we actually recorded it the first time. So by the time it got to that soundstage at Bray, it had kind of relaxed a bit. Do you know what I mean? And it had been played. We'd played it on stage in an electric format quite a lot. It's always interesting to see how something that you've done electrically will work in an acoustic format, like Layla, or like when you just take it down in dynamics to be playing it really quiet.
Well, we know that your affection for him is genuine. As a matter of fact, he's looking at us right now from your wall.
Yeah, there he is. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if anybody ever says to you, should you continue to perform live? I would always say yes, because I would not have seen Muddy Waters had you not had him as a support artist.
Right.
When he was an older man.
Yes.
So I'm glad I saw him.
Yeah,
so,
me too.
You know, so keep going, because there are younger people who wouldn't have seen you.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot in it for me. I've taken this year off, and I've had a great time. And I needed to do that to find out if I could retire, because a lot of people can't, you know, and I don't feel like anything drastic is going to happen if I stop playing. What I've experienced is that I love listening to music even if I don't play. So I'm not driven or compelled to play. It's something I love to do. I recognize that it's also my job too. But, you know, the guitar sits in the corner of my room. Sometimes I pick it up and sometimes I don't. But next year I go back to work. I'm in a very enviable, I'm in a very fortunate position to be able to do something like that, that's born out of love and passion, you know.
And to get through your whole career doing it.
Yeah.
You've done the gig. Are you thinking, oh, that was good? Or are you thinking, ooh?
I thought it was good. I thought it was great, in fact. Much better than I thought it would be. And I thought, well, this is going to be a quite a nice TV show. I had no idea where it was going to go. And of course, you know, it kind of set a benchmark. I mean, people are going to, well, you're going to do the next one. And I thought, I'm not going to do it. I mean, I won't do anything like that again. And actually, I think it will be a pretty hard act to follow. But it might be a nice, I mean, maybe this time in my life is the right time to do it.
Of course, the unsung hero here is Russ Titelman.
Yeah.
Because he's the guy who has to put together all the bits.
Yeah.
So he did a great job.
He did a great job. And of course, because of that, we went and did From the Cradle. The essence of what we did here was taken to that concept whereby we had a full band in the studio on the floor playing live, and if any one person didn't like their bit, we had to all do it again on that. You know, that was the deal. And we'd do one song a day until we felt we were all happy. So it was totally live, no overdubs or anything, and that was Russ. Russ was the guy I looked at on the other side of the glass, and I trusted him, you know, and I still do.
One curious fact that pumped up the anticipation of a recording of this was because MTV doesn't just show something once.
Mm.
Did you actually watch a transmission?
I think I may have done seen bits of it. I don't think I ever watched the whole thing all the way through. That particular concept hadn't occurred to me either. I thought it was just a one-off show that would get shown once. In those days, it was, you know, the rotation thing hadn't really fully spawned then.
So if only through the maximization of the number of people seeing it,
yeah,
there was a demand for a record.
Yeah. But where it kind of backfired was we went out on the road and we were playing these huge venues. Well, we started our tour of America in Texas, outdoor show, walked out and tried to play these things acoustically, and I couldn't hear a word because they were just, they went, because Tears in Heaven had been a number one by that point. And I was trying to perform acoustically in front of people. It was a bit like the Beatles, really. I felt what they felt at that point. And I would come off stage either in tears or in so angry, because they, people get so hysterical when they're seeing something that they've invested in some way. And they bought the record and they, or they talk about it amongst them, and they go and they get excited and they can't contain themselves. And all you could hear was people yelling and screaming. So we actually stopped performing Unplugged. We couldn't play acoustically for quite a long time. I mean, I did about a tour like that, and maybe it was about 3 weeks, and I said, we can't do this anymore. It's impossible. It's actually physically impossible.
And I suppose with Tears in Heaven, until it became a song with its own life, rather than an emotional reaction to you, it must have been very odd to hear people whooping, which would have been inappropriate.
It was, yeah. It was completely wrong. And not to them, because it was a hit single. And that's what they were responding to. And I can't, you know, there's no way to sit in judgment on any of that. That's, it's exciting. If you, I mean, I'm the same. If I hear something that I've invested something into, I get moved. Maybe I'm, because I'm a musician, I know how to correctly respond, you know, and sit quietly. But it was difficult. It was a it was very confusing.
And then comes the ultimate shower of compliments, the Grammy Awards.
Oh, yeah, my God.
And you get six.
It was ridiculous, yeah. Well, I was nominated for more, too, you know.
I know. So up you go, back and forth.
Yeah.
Did you have six acceptance speeches?
I can't remember what I said, actually. I didn't really want to go. The overall thing about this was, this is my take, it was supposed to be a little TV show. This has gone mad. It's out of control. Now they're giving me, what's a Grammy? Who wants a Grammy? Any? I don't want I don't like awards, by the way. I really don't know how that works. I don't believe it. Don't necessarily buy into it. And it was, again, Roger Forrest who said, you have to go, because this is actually a proper award. You've been voted in by your peers. There's no bullshit around this. And I went and I saw it and I looked at her and I thought, yeah, there is nothing commercial here. It's proper. And, you know, well, it isn't to me anymore. It's kind of gone the way of all these TV shows. But at the time I got it, I was extremely, I mean, like everything else, about the whole experience, it kind of gave me validation for my taste and my journey in music. What I believed in could be passed on. That's what I found.
And in your own life, amongst your many recordings, where does this sit?
Well, I always think Layla's the one. You know, there was something brutally honest about that record. My heart and soul was in that album. And Journeyman is a great album, you know, and Reptile and Pilgrim are great albums. I mean, I'm very proud of most of my work. But this one is the odd one out because it's the one I didn't mean to make. It got out against all of my, you know, all of my manipulation and maneuvering came to nothing. It sold despite itself. I suppose it's kind of got a unique position amongst all of it, really.
Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.
That's great.
Good fun.